Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So Professor Spiros Amouris is now going to be our keynote speaker.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I'll try to take you through a promenade over a long period as a background for what will follow up in tomorrow's presentations. And before I get into the visual material, I just wanted to say that, you know, the Greek history goes a long time, several thousands of years, but I use two phases or two periods of Greek history as critical inheritance, I should say, not tradition, to modern Greece. One is the ancient period, which was from 800 before Christ to the Roman conquest in 200 before Christ. And the second one is the period that Greece was then under foreign occupation, Roman Empire, as part of a province of the Roman Empire, later on Byzantium, and later on conquered by the Ottomans and the Ottoman Empire that lasted till the 19th century. During this period, why I start from 800 BC, or closely 1000 BC, if you like, you know, that's why the rounded figure of 3,000 years, of continual evolution and developments, sometimes progressive and sometimes regressive. Nevertheless, it was continuous. It wasn't like a civilization that blossomed like some of those that we see in the Americas, like the Incas, for example, or the Mayas, and then, you know, they disappeared. Or they were transposed like the Mesopotamians, for example, you know, with the more recent Arab, let's say, culture and civilization. In Greece, it was sort of a continual development with the same people in the same land, in the same place. Greece reached, and you will see the icons as I go along, about 1000 BC, until about 1000 before Christ, Greek communities were very much feudal communities. There was a king, a chief, some leader of some of a tribe, if you like, or of a certain region. And this is the plan of Dimini in the Thessaly, in the middle part of the mainland of Greece, where in the inner circle you see the Megaron, which is the building there, which was the house of the leader of the feudal lord. Inside the walls, there were the priests, there were the servants, the soldiers for defense, and their housing within the second walls. And at times of attack from other tribes of the countryside, the farmers who are living out in the country will come in with their livestock inside the walls and fight and defend themselves. So we see this kind of organic plan development of the communities along a feudal system, that this type of, let's say, community plans and organization along the similar lines of a political system occurred in Europe when the tribes of Europe, of Northern Europe and Western Europe, began to settle. And that is what the Middle Ages looked like until the time of the Renaissance. And this is a plan of a German town, you know, dating up to the 12th, 13th century. From then on, we see a different approach to the development of the towns. In Greece, by that time, before Christ now, I'm going back again, back and forward in history, as in this plan of Olynthos, a city in Macedonia, central Macedonia, Greek Macedonia, which is in the Chalkidiki region. It's just about a few scores of kilometers east of Thessaloniki. We see the development, because of changes, political changes, the development of another way of life, urban life. In other words, people who were living in cities who were not anymore farmers, but they may have had income from farming with other people working, who were merchants, who were having what we call today's, you know, service perhaps and commercial. They were involved with service and commercial activities. And they were people who were experimenting with different political systems. In other words, we see the breakup of the feudal system and, in the archaeologist's term, some of those cities as democratic cities. So we have the people who lived within the city had all the same rights. And in this case, in the case of the Plan of Olynthos, you see the A, which is the old Acropolis, the ancient, if you like, settlement of the feudal days, which ceased to be a residential unit, but it became now simply the sanctuary, you know, which was the last defense point, if you like, in times of attack. But basically, it was the temples and whatever, you know, religious buildings that were already in the old town. And we see the development now of a regular street pattern and city block organization of what was now a place of living for people who were not involved directly with their living. I mean, they were not earning their living directly from the land. In other words, they were urbanites. So this type of plans seemed to be organized with this, on a basis of a number of criteria, primarily relating to nature. Why? For their own safety. For their own from floods, for their own convenience in terms of not having to go like San Francisco streets going up and down perpendicular to the land contours, rather on a diagonal, which is more convenient. So they were very carefully sited. Orientation was always to the south, or at least in the southeast side. Of course, it depended on the original location, which was more dictated by defensive reasons of the old towns, the old settlement, which was more or less the Acropolis. And so here you see the skeleton of the main street, if you like, and the key facilities, and they are dispersed. What does that mean, dispersed now within the grid of a city plan? Well, they were dispersed because these cities were not having any more a king. They were not feudal communities, but the people had all equal rights. So there was no reason, and I will compare it to a Roman plan cities, if you like, with another slide in a few minutes, where, you know, it didn't matter. They didn't have to have a central square where everything is happening, where the leaders are living, you know, the community, and then the people live in the periphery and so on. But the location of various functions was determined by the use of the landscape, the morphology of the ground. In other words, and when I was teaching, I used to tell the students that the Greeks were actually lazy. Instead of building a theater, they chose the land that was suitable to put the sitting, and instead of building a stadium, they used again an appropriate formation of the ground, which with the sitting will become a good stadium. So you see in this one, for example, the more flat part, which is the D, is the agora. You see how difficult it is to set, but nevertheless the city blocks, more or less, and the streets work on a diagonal, and so it will be more convenient to walk. And similar plans we see in various cities in the mainland of Greece, from the north, which is present Macedonia and Thrace, to the west of Greece, which is Cassiope, facing the Ionian Sea, to the Asia Minor, to Sicily, to wherever they were building along the Black Sea and all the way along the Mediterranean. And this plan was attributed to Hippodamus of Miletos. Hippodamus is better known as a planner, and also was attributed other characteristics like meteorologist or sociologist, because he was concerned about the organization of the cities, about the social organization. He was concerned about the response to the climate that I was referring before. And so, you know, the climate was important also, don't forget, because in those days, no electricity, no oil. You know, they only had wood for warming their houses. And so what they did was they tried to locate, if possible and however possible, closer to the south-southeast orientation, so that the sun in the summer, with the appropriate design of the buildings, could be excluded, and in the winter, when in December the sun goes down almost to 27 degrees, you know, angle, can penetrate the buildings and warm the interior of the living spaces, so that the floors, you know, would accumulate some of the heat and diminish some of the cold. Of course, they used also fireplaces, I mean, or fires, you know, to boost up the conditions. So what is interesting is that although all those plans were regular grid plans as we know them today, nevertheless, they varied according to the location by utilizing the natural features. So in this case of Priin, which is on the north, it's on the Asia Minor coast, and it is on the north part of the delta of the river Meander. And on the south side is another city, which you will see in a few minutes, Miletos. And so the hatched lines on the sketch, on the upper part, is where the Acropolis used to be. And the town, when it expanded and became organized, was built on the south slope. What's interesting is that, well, I said before, you know, that they, on the slope they found the convenient angle that they built their theater. They found the more flat part where they have the agora. They placed the temple at the end of a small canyon. Rather than filling it in, they used this natural little sort of canyon with the vegetation in it, where it was somehow the terminus of the temple of Athena, you know, the goddess and the nature. So turning something which would have been a handicap, they turn it into an advantage. This is a slide of the theater I was pointing before, you know, so it's higher up on the slope. And this is from another angle, the theater of Priin. Of course, now, you know, these places, after they were destroyed at some point, you know, they actually were covered by natural vegetation and they had to be excavated. Also, erosion of the ground, you know, fell over the ruins. And sometimes also, even if they were attacked and the population had to move, or over the centuries, you know, some of these old towns, you know, were destroyed further by earthquakes as well, you know, because all these countries, all these parts I'm referring, are also earthquake country. And here in this picture, you see the Acropolis being on the top of this defensive rock, whereas the city was built on the more flat or the more even slope of the south, on the south side. This is a reconstruction from the German School of Archaeology, which excavated Priin, and it gives you an idea of the image of the community. Now, the grid plan, as I said, it changed depending on the topography and the conditions of the land wherever it was actually located. And this is the plan of Rhodes, which is on the island of Rhodes. And so there was a question of a harbor, which is to the right of the plan. And it's also below what is today the castle, which used to be the old Acropolis. And so on the more even ground, they built the city. But in this case, they decided to use a strip, which starts from the sea and goes across the city, in which they placed most of the public facilities, whereas the commercial and the harbor facilities were along the coast. So although we have a grid plan, which we're all familiar, as most of the U.S. cities are on a grid plan organization, nevertheless, it was each one was different from the others. Why? Because of the different topography, the different formation of the ground, and the different orientation, as they were always trying to take advantage of the natural phenomena. They also were considered about the winds. I showed before the plan of Miletos, and this is the plan of Priin, which is on the north part of the delta of the river Meander as it hits the Mediterranean, the Aegean. And this is the plan of Miletos, which was on the south side, and it's also the home city of the planner Hippodamos. Hippodamos was also the planner of the port of Piraeus. Anybody who has been to Greece and has been to the port of Piraeus, the grid of the old city of Piraeus is built over the old grid of the Hippodamian plan. Now, if we look at the way the Romans were building, which were the following period, we see here the plan of Timkad, which is in the North African coast, and it was built by Augustus to house the legionaries who fought in North Africa. And when the legions were for a very long time, they were allowed, if they didn't marry local girls, to bring their wives from Italy, from Rome, and settle also, as they became also the first permanent residents in the new territories that they were conquering. So this was the city plan, which is typical of the Roman plan. Rome was an empire. It was an empire. It had emperors. It was oligarchic rule. So hierarchy was very important and very strong in the Roman society. In other words, you know, and we see here the basic Roman plan was actually the north, south, and east, west, two main streets, with the Forum, which is the Agora, which is the central square of the town, being almost in the center of the town, where most of the important people lived around, and the rest of the people lived further and further towards the periphery. This plan, of course, originated from the military plan of the camps of the Roman army when they set up tents as they were marching through the campaigns, you know. And I may be tiring those of you that are architects, but for the non-architects' benefit, you know, the square is easier to pitch. You can imagine what chaos would have been if a Roman legion was attacked. And in those days, without walkie-talkies and so on, there would be an absolute chaos. So when they pitched their tents, you know, they cut and divided the city, the camp into a grid where they had the regiments, they had the companies, they had the platoons. And so when there was an emergency or anything, you know, they can get up and sort of immediately assemble and be able ready to fight. A square, of course, with the four corners having patrols observing, was also a defensive space. So quite often, as I said, you know, these Roman camps, which originally were for a long time, became permanent, and they were built along those lines. And several cities in Europe, their original plan goes back to the days of the Roman Empire, and also, you know, I mean, cities that are better known also, like Florence. The street that runs to Ponte Vecchio, you know, and crosses down, is part of the old Roman main, the Cardomus. The wisdom of how to build was, let's say, tabulated and recorded by Vitruvius with further information and observations and guidelines in his famous volumes. In the 17th century, we face another period of colonization, which was the Spanish discovery of colonies in the Americas primarily. And, of course, the Spanish, Philip II of Spain in the 17th century, based a lot on Vitruvius, they developed a series of guidelines and rules called the Law of the Indies, which dictated how to build a city, and they could not necessarily trust a very capable captain, a military man good in fighting, to be a good planner also. So they had rules like when you come with your ship, when you anchor your ship somewhere, search for an area which is facing south, or if it was in the south, facing north, so that they have sunlight. Watch out which were the flood lines, the barriers of the river, so you built above that. You know, they were giving practical rules how to build, one of which was also the basic plan of organization, which is what New Haven has been built on originally the center part of New Haven, and it's the nine squares called plat or trata, which were divided, which were divided into feather lots where people build their houses, and the central park remained as a square where you had the public buildings, and there was also a limit around the city, which was not nobody was allowed to build, so that they could actually expand in a planned manner. And so, you know, there was always some logic and some criteria that were obeyed. Of course, the rectilinear plan, you know, the rectilinear city block organization was not a Greek invention. In India, there are also signs. They found the archaeologists' ruins, which illustrate that the Indians also were using rectilinear city blocks to organize their cities. We think today that we are smart because we have building laws that determine the height of buildings and so on and so forth. They were already in use from those days. And similarly to the Greek 8th century BC, we see also the development in China organized plans of towns based on a different logic, but basically on the right angle and rectilinear development subdivision of a town. When the Emperor Chu or Choi, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, consolidated a lot of the tribes that formed the various parts that were living in the various parts of China, and in order to make permanent the control of the whole territory, you know, they built actually a series of towns which were the sort of ruling places. Of course, the rectilinear plan, we see that also being used also into the new countries like the United States. And here we see the plans of Philadelphia and Savannah. And also being democratic societies, a democratic society, you know, obviously the idea was to develop, a more neutral matrix where there were public facilities. So in Philadelphia, they developed into four quarters, which have four parks or squares, and the same thing with Savannah, where we have many more spread around. In other words, all citizens enjoying the same rights, the same amenities. Evolution in Europe, or if you like, the development in the European space in the Renaissance period, where the cities became expanded, first of all, and became more organized, we see already the use of the diagonal, and in this case, you know, with two examples which illustrate also, but still monarchies, I mean still oligarchic political systems where we have kings, the King of France, for example. So, you know, Versailles, for example, is actually pivotal. The palace is pivotal as the key point and focal point, as it was the leader of the country, and so as the most important figure. And on the other hand, the gardens that the king enjoyed, the same as the Duke of Karlsruhe, you know, where you have the city of Karlsruhe spread out on a radial pointing towards the palace of the Duke. The diagonal now gets inserted in some modern plans, and in the United States, a good example is the Washington, D.C., you know, where, you know, you begin to create a matrix of cross diagonals over the rectilinear subdivision of the city blocks of the city. Now, going back again in time to the cities we saw before, I explained, you know, the difference in the plan organization, which were mainly in terms of the utilization of the land inside the city, between the Roman and the Greek plan, which had to do with the political system. And in the Greek case, the environment was the critical factor. In the Roman case, it was the political system, the hierarchy that the society lived with, that determined this centrality and nucleus within the city. The same thing happened with the houses. First of all, the city blocks in the various Greek cities, and here we see the typical city block of Athira, which is also in Thrace, in northern Greece, northeastern Greece today. It's always a courtyard, and the courtyard was designed in a way that the living quarters were always on the north, facing south, and the ancillary spaces and the servants were living on the south, or in other cases they were also on wings east and west. But the masters of the house and citizens of the city who had priority in the amenities lived in the healthier quarter, if you like. And here we see a city block in Avdira, in this case, where we have actually four properties deep, and there are these little passages that led into the internal locked lots, which is sort of an interesting way. Because the citizens, because all the citizens were actually of the same, they were equal, there was no reason to sort of, and there was no political hierarchy. You know, they were all free citizens, and then there were the, depending whether they were having an assembly, whether they had a smaller assembly of three or four tyranny, as they called them at the time, and I won't go into the semantics of the words, council, if you like, there was no reason to, let's say, make apparent the status of the people who lived in the house. So the entrance would be wherever it was convenient. In the Roman house, the organization of the courtyard was actually axial, because from the first moment that you entered a house with a courtyard, because superficially they look the same, they were courtyard organization. They had a courtyard in the middle. You had to see from the statues of the family and the statues of the members of the statues of the gods worshipped by the family and the statues of the family, you should be able to tell whether you are entering the house of a centurion, of a general, of a senator, or whoever, you know. And so, you know, it was more important. Therefore, they didn't follow the rule of the Greeks that all the living quarters were to the north, but quite often, if the city block was facing, as quite often they would, north-south, the north side facing houses would have an entrance from the north. So the living quarters will be south-facing north, not getting sun. Of course, as engineers, they were providing hot water, you know, and so they were heating their houses. But the political system was dictating rather than the natural phenomena which were taken advantage, as in the case of the Greek houses. So the land formation, nature, the orientation, the wind movements, and the sizes of the city blocks varied so that they could be designed on the ground in such a way that they would be more or less diagonal, the contours, and so it would be soft rising, you know, instead of being, you know, on an inclination like San Francisco's grid, which is regardless of the inclination of the ground, you know. And we have a variety of houses, you know, where in some cases like the Priene house, you know, it's a sort of more narrow lot. The sizes of the lots also, by the way, during the Greek times, I mean the period of 800 to 200, rather, sorry, 300 up to 300, there were 2,000 square feet. There were 200 square meters. Whether they were rectilinear like that or more square like in other examples I showed. During the Hellenistic times, they became more rich because Alexander the Great had gone all the way down to India. They had trade and money coming in from various parts of the world. So all of a sudden, you know, houses became bigger. They were about 3,000 square feet. And in Roman times, they were as big as 6,000 square feet, the lots. Now, this is from Olynthos, where there is a court, is a three-sided, if you like, courtyard arrangement. Now, when we have a prototype, as for the plan that is adapted to different locations, we have also this prototype of a courtyard adapted for the reasons I mentioned before, and also because of the climate, depending where it was. Now, this is a house from the town of the city of Dura Evropos, which was built in the Hellenistic times, in the 4th century BC, in the desert of where is Iraq now, you know, in the Mesopotamia. And in the desert, of course, the living quarters have been reversed. They are on the south side, facing north, so that they could keep cool instead of you know, being on the north side. In other words, they had a model, but they were not sort of applying it regardless, blindfolded, but they were actually adapting it as it was necessary. What's also more important, you know, and of course here is the section, a section of Prien, but it's pretty typical that, you know, it would always, the angle of the sun would be such in the summer that would be they called prostas, this front part which was columns and covered, which cut the sun, it didn't allow the sun to come inside. But in the winter, it would allow the sun to penetrate in the building and warm the floors, you know. So we have this as well as in section. And, of course, you know, this also allowed the wind movement, especially those towns that were close to the coast, you know, where you have the difference between the nightly and day winds and movements. I liked always this axonometric, this model in showing, you know, the a city block of Prien, and I used to sometimes ask colleagues and say, hiding, of course, the caption of what it was, say, who designed that? And that's a comment for the architects in the audience. Was it Aldo Rossi? Was it Matthias Ungers or one of the postmodernist boys? And it looks quite contemporary, doesn't it? Yet it was built the 5th century BC in Prien, you know, and the arrangements. The roofs also were varied, you know, there were more steep or less steep roofs, you know, depending where they were. And in Dura Evropos, you know, which was in the desert, they were totally flat. Of course, this was the period that followed what was before. And I showed you one of the earlier examples of this feudal communities or citadels from Dimini before, but which had evolved to quite a sophisticated, if you like, organization as the Minoan civilization, the Knossos in Crete, which was up to 1500 years BC, you know, from earlier on, and also Mycenae, on the mainland, you know, which was where Agamemnon, who led the expedition to Troy, the king of Mycenae, and that's the citadel of Mycenae, which was the sort of more developed form of this medieval. Similar to the planning and the houses, we have also, you know, rather sophisticated resolution of public buildings, and in this case, you know, this is the Temple of Apollo of Vase in the middle of the, or rather on the western side of the middle part of the Peloponnese Mountains. And again, this is done by the architects who did the Parthenon. And the Parthenon was the prototypical of a Doric order temple. So you would think that the same prototype will be applied everywhere. No, this was different. And the reason that was different, because this was the temple of the god of sun, Apollo. And being located high up on a mountain, it had employed the three orders. Externally, had Doric columns. Internally, like piers on the wall at an angle, were Ionic columns. And in the middle, just where today you would say is the altar, where it was the statue of the god, which was a bit to the right, there was a column which was Corinthian. The Corinthian column was a more decorative. It had almost, the shadow of it could have looked like the head of a person, if you like, with hair sort of all over the place. And whereas all the temples were oriented on an east-west axis, here it was oriented on the north-south axis. And not only that, but it had a door opposite the altar, I mean the part where the statue was, on the east side. And the reason why it was done like that, and it was variation, adaptation of the model, was because they were using the sun as it broke through the mountains on a certain day of the year when they were celebrating they were celebrating some festivity for the god of sun, Apollo. The priests were leading the pilgrims coming from Olympia up to the mountain, and with the drums they were guiding them at a rhythm so that they would arrive and enter the temple at the point where the sun will break through the top of the mountains east from Arcadia. And all of a sudden, at a time that they were not aware of electricity, I mean, they didn't have the knowledge we have that if you switch the light and you have a strong lamp, you get a beam of light hitting somewhere. The sun will sort of gush into the through the open door into the temple, and there will be so the column, the Ionic column, will be in shadow, and there will be a kind of play between the statue of Apollo that the sun would hit it and the shadow, and it will look as if the god moved. And the columns as piers on the walls on the side were at an angle to further cast a shadow as the light came in, so the walls intensify, in other words, the darkness in the room. All those and the refinements of the Acropolis, you know, of the Parthenon, sorry, were showing, including the design of the theaters and the acoustics, a highly sophisticated understanding of physics, actually, and optics, you know, I mean, acoustics and optics in terms of the refinement of the buildings. But as in the plans of the cities, as in the plans of the houses, so also with the temples, you know, they were adapting them to the needs, to what was the objective, and to get the best results from the needs. You have to remember that in those days, the cities of the Greek space were actually city-states. They were independent political units. And so we see the same criteria, the same models being used. In other words, the best practices were used by adopted by different city-states and by different people, not because they were policed by laws through a central government, but by accepting and understanding the benefits of good practices. And to me, at least, that is a sign of civilization. And I won't say of Greeks, but I will say of those people, because, you know, I'm not so sure who we are now by comparison to those. Now, a second phase is the phase that Greece was conquered by the Romans, and so you have a shift of power, and the city-states slowly dried up, stopped being urban centers, stopped being centers of letters and arts and knowledge and industries and so on, but all those moved into the bigger political centers, you know, Rome first and later on Constantinople. So ultimately, the countryside in the mainland of Greece and the islands turn into rural activities. So we see a switch over from an urban civilization to a rural civilization. It wasn't the inverted climate that caused the Anasazi to change into nomadic people, you know, where they changed again totally life. But these people, they didn't move, they stayed in the same place, but now they had to add some more criteria and a different way of life. The additional criteria was that now they had to be defensive, either from the rulers, if they sometimes broke the rules, to defend themselves from mainly in the Ottoman period, but also from other races attacking the Greek space, including the Crusaders who came from Western and Northern Europe on their way to Jerusalem or to free the Holy Land. And, of course, you know, when they found a good place and good food and conveniently stayed there, you know, for a while. So we have this regression into a rural society. Around the 16th century, we begin now some of those communities which had become totally dependent in agriculture and animal husbandry and forestry and so on, they began trading also. They began manufacturing and become more wealthy. And so we see getting involved with trade and shipping also, you know. So, and this is just an indication only, an example of how these communities evolved during what has been a more recent inheritance again to contemporary Greece. And in some respects, there are similar criteria except that here there is also the additional of defensive space. Now, it so happened that the plan of this, the plan I'm showing to you is because only because I had material as I worked on the master plan of this island. It's the island of Skyros, where in the Troy expedition, Achilles' mother hid her son at the palace of the king, which was located in the Acropolis on the Acropolis is up there, and the ancient community was on that side. The rest of it was actually expanded on the south side in the 16th century onwards. And of course, it followed the topography. They built on the high ground. They let the little valleys free so that the water can run away instead of flooding the lower parts. So this place had been continually inhabited, at least historically we know, for 3,000 years. You know, it's a community built over and over. Now, being very steep, that hill, you know, it wasn't very easy to build immediately under the Acropolis on that side, so they had to go where there was a little bit more even ground, and then on a more softer slope of the topography as it expanded. And this is pretty much surveyed pretty much before it was further developed. In other words, this is what was the development up to the 19th, early 20th century. And you can see that different typology evolves, because here now we have people who actually were living from the land. They didn't live a grand life. They had no servants. So they normally, if they had a two-story house, as you will see some examples going through the various parts of the country, would actually have their animals were on the ground floor and they were living above. That had an added advantage also, because in the summer, in the winter, the animals were also were actually warming up the basement, you know, the ground floor. And so they were not having losses, at least heat losses, from the upper part with the living quarters. But this is an unusual case because of the very steep ground. There were very small houses. You know, they didn't have dynamite. They couldn't explode. They didn't have compressors, you know, to break up the rock, you know, and create bigger terraces. So they were rather small houses and very efficient too. Those evolved now, again, the streets and the way the land was subdivided was done in such a way that would be convenient, not very steep to go up, but at convenient angles to move in and out from the community. And having small houses, they were using the outdoors, you know, this sample of a pedestrian street, a main street in the community, as outdoor living. You know, the evening they would sit out there and chat with their neighbors and so on and so forth. And as it was so confined on the slide on the right side here, up to at least 1970s, they used to every so often, you know, when they whitewashed with lime the walls, they would also draw this line, which they called eyebrow, like the ladies, you know, they used the same expression. And this was because, being so confined in space, it was very important to say, this is my territory. This is public and this is mine. So, you know, there was just this fine line which remained as a custom. Each region in Greece, because of the various, the variety of microclimates, began adapting, I mean, the architecture was adapting to the microclimate and to the social and economic factors of these islands. And so, you know, this is the island of Patmos and the castle up there, and it's the monastery, a defensive space, was the monastery where St. John wrote the Gospel, one of the four Gospel writers. And the city, of course, you know, the houses that you see, quite big, they were built in the 18th, 19th century, by those who went to the sea and became captains, and they were quite rich, so they built bigger houses, you know. And this is a shot from higher up, you know, of the main town, which is high up on the mountain, again defensive from the pirates. By the time they reach up there, with cannons they could protect themselves. And the island is actually like a number eight. It has it's divided into two parts with a narrow porthmos, which connects the one part to the other part of the island. Of course, in the Middle Ages, we have cities like Mistra, which were destroyed, which were really very much, you know, organic plan, enclosed within walls. And this was the last seat of the last it was the seat of the last emperor of Byzantium, when finally only a small part of Greece was still free, till finally it capitulated, it gave in. And here is a group of Californian architectural students in the Aeropolis, which is in Peloponnese, another place which is very barren. It's very desert-like, and the people there had built houses like towers, actually, where they lived, and they would actually defend themselves from pirates and from attackers. And this is also a part of Greece which has, like, they also have this private vendetta. And so, you know, they're literally individual castles, if you like. A shot from Onembasia, and what I found very curious is that the only place I've seen this kind of detail of a narrow pedestrian street and shops, I've seen it in Japan, where you have the wood shutter goes up, and it has some wrought iron supports below, and this goes down at night, so it closes. And during the day, this becomes a display. Now, this is deserted, the shop, but this became a display, so they would put their ware, you know, they would put their vegetables or whatever they were selling, and they would have the window open and passerby, you know, because narrow streets, and they were economizing the space. There's another shot of the passages and the houses in Monembasia. That's really a medieval city, port city castle. You know, it's an enclosed space, because the upper part is the castle. Below is the city, walled on a rock, which has a narrow passage to the mainland, very defensive space. Parallel to this civil architecture, we have also architecture, the religious architecture, and this is a shot from the monastery of Mount Athos of Simonas Petra, where you had 8 and 9 stories high towers built on the cliffs. Again, you know, being north, it was good to have these balconies, you know, where they could actually sit in the summer, you know, and in the winter the sun would sort of come inside and protect them also from the rain and the windows. Religious architecture, monasteries, we have also in the Thessaly, in the middle part of Greece, on the east side of the spine that divides from north to south Greece mountain range. These are meteora. Those of you that may remember one of the James Bond films, I think, supposedly he flew with a kite from one of those monasteries. And the only way you could go up and down was with a basket, you know, that the monks would sort of crank up and down and bring their food. But it was defensible space. Now, moving to the Aegean, with the strong winds in the summer, this is an olive tree in the island of Andros. I happened to see it, and I made a photograph of that, because it shows the olive tree, which is so difficult, so tough also as a tree, you know, from very young. It took the shape of the prevailing winds. You can see how strong the forces of nature are. And, of course, the same with architecture. Now, in the islands, they used they were raising pigeons also, which were part of their diet. But, you know, the bird droppings are very rich chemical fertilizers. So the pigeon houses, particularly in the island of Tinos, are well known, because, you know, these holes you see there were designed so that they were not just a damp thing, you know, but it was an object which was pleasant to see. allowed the birds to go in and out, and they were nesting there. Therefore, the droppings were collected, and they were using them for their vegetable garden. And as quite often has been said by a number of architects, that architecture is not just only satisfying the utilities, the needs of people, but it's just, it's more than that, and that then it's architecture, you know. And it's what I would say often, you know, that a good plan or a good section is not a diagram, you know, it's more than that, it's a building, you know. Mykonos, another island, you know, where you have these sort of strong walls, small openings because of the strong winds. Here is a well-known chapel of Mykonos. And I've seen reconstructions that archaeologists have made of the houses of Delos, which is just off Mykonos, which suffers from very strong winds in the summer. And it looks already from antiquity that whereas the other houses had windows also facing outside, in the ancient cities, the houses in Delos were not dissimilar aesthetically to what we see, only they were bigger scale, considerably bigger scale than those houses of we see today. Then we have another island, you know, Santorini, which is the old volcano, and there is natural cement there, so they were building barrel vault structures. And so the architecture was adapted to the opportunities and the materials. Another island on the southeastern part of the Aegean, or off the Aegean, you know, it's actually between near Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, which is more humid, and therefore we don't have flat roofs, we have the pitch roofs. And Castel Orizo, which is almost by the Turkish coast, the mountains you see are the Turkish coast on the other side, where we have more rain, it's more humid. And so, you know, the houses appropriately adjusted to that. Hydra, which is near Athens, a small island on the north coast of Peloponnese, a shipping island known for its, which was for the first time since the antiquity, apparently inhabited again since the antiquity in the 17th, 18th century, and it developed into a sort of maritime force in the Mediterranean. And these are captain's houses, now very barren island now, which, of course, you know, they were using stone to build their houses. Going up north, where the sun is quite is welcomed in the winter, and as I said before, the ground floor were used to house the animals. In Castoria, which is almost close to the it's actually close to the triangle of it, between Albania. I lost track which of these new democracies north of Greece are. It's Kosovo or Macedonia, and anyhow, Castoria. Houses in the middle of Greece, you know, on the mountains of Pelio in Thessaly, where there is a lot of slate. Have slate used for roof, and the upper floor, again, as I said, you know, for the winter, you know, it's quite welcome to open all those shutters and have the sun coming in and warming the house. The summer, you know, they close the shutters and protect themselves from the reflected heat. Dimitsana, which is in the middle of the mountain, it's in the middle in the mountain area of Peloponnese, and Professor Spiros Polalis tomorrow will show you some of the areas that have been burned last summer, you know, and has been working with his students there. And finishing, I thought you'll say, okay, you told us all about Greece and the climate and the landscape and so on and so on, and how, as you asked before, how do you respond as an architect? I thought I'll show you just two projects that I have been involved in. In this project, I had the pleasure to work also with Professor Dimitris Sayas, you know, was working with us. It's actually a college in the north of Greece on the plateau of just north of Kozani, on the beginning of the plateau of Ptolemais. And it is a technical college which faces north. The classrooms, The lecture rooms are facing north. Then you have the laboratories and workshops on the lower part. And then on the south side, you have the dormitories with courtyards. And on the very top, there is a courtyard with green and an enclosed concourse, which actually is the entrance on the other end. And you have the amphitheater, you have the library, you have the restaurant cafeteria for the day students, and the restaurant for the boarding for the dormitories is down there. And these are additions. This and this big thing is an addition which was built like this, also tall there. You know, this is the original design. So the idea was to build the, on the diagram here, to build internal streets for the movement of students facing north for the classrooms and the dorms on the other side. Here you can see one of these passages that at each level they lead you to a classroom on that side. And as it was following the curve, the contour, so it was actually staggered the way the classrooms were. That's why you see these setbacks. And this is the external view of this passage. That's a side view from that. And as I said, the internal concourse was like an internal street, which you know allowed the students something like 15 feet wide. You know, which in the cold days, you know, the students can sort of move between the various parts of the building. So you had the working or teaching, I mean, the working areas or teaching areas, the living areas, and the very top, you know, the central facilities for both sides. So the environment played a very serious consideration. And then in the south again, this is a development for 10 units for rental for the summer, where the ground floor units had a garden facing towards the bay, and that's where they were stepped back as they were going up down. And on the units on the top had the roof the roof of the next one as a roof garden where they can enjoy the view and the and although you know it looks Greek if you like because not only because of the white but the geometry and the game of it, there isn't a single feature which you can say it's actually copying a Mykonos window or a Mykonos or Santorini or one of the Aegean islands. And with that, I would like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to tire you, I suppose. I did go a little over the hour. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.